I'm delighted to be here, and thank you very much indeed to the organisers for inviting me to come along. And also wanted to say how much I enjoyed Thomas's presentation that we just heard. So I thought I would really deliver this talk in about five different parts, because I thought that would give me 5 minutes on each, and that might give you a sense that things were moving along without too many, you know, longer. I'm not going to talk all that much about my own work, but I will initially show you a few slides from some of my field sites, and I'm very, very happy to discuss my own research if anybody wants to do so. Since it's a little bit distant from medieval history, I thought I would keep that in the background. So when I've told you a little bit about what I've done myself, I'm going to try and present to you a few of what I think are the current debates and paradigms about conversion that have been preoccupying anthropologists generally. And this will connect in some ways with what Thomas has said. But just to give you a sense of my own fieldwork, I've done really three projects in three different places, the third one of which I'm still engaged in now. And these first slides are from my fieldwork in the Philippines, the Roman Catholic Philippines, in an area called Bicol, which is in central Luzon. And that was the subject of my first book. And that book was not entirely about Christianity, and it certainly wasn't entirely about conversion, but it was about the question of what it means to live the practice of an unusual kind of Christianity. And I think that's one of the things that has been an underlying theme in all the work I do. So in the background to all my thinking about what it meant to be a Roman Catholic Filipino person living in a village, and to negotiate Roman Catholic meanings with the Philippine clergy, there's also underlying that question, a set of questions, obviously, about the history of conversion in the Philippines, which is a double history, the history of Spanish conversion and then the history of the American period and its legacy. So that's the sort of the background to some of my Philippine work. After I finished that, I did this book, The Anthropology of Christianity, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. And my second field project was rather different, but also looking at an unusual kind of Christian practice, because this is field work in, I don't know if anybody's been to Utah, that's Salt Lake City in Utah. And I've done field work with Latter-day Saints, Mormons, in upstate New York in the east and in Utah in the west. That's Salt Lake City in the snow, which I think is very beautiful. I quite like these photographs because they make me understand a little bit of how Latter-day Saints can think of their city as Zion, you know, as heaven on earth, but give or take a few rather ugly downtown office blocks, which we'll overlook. that's the Salt Lake City Temple. So part of my interest in Mormonism came out of the fact that, as some of you probably know, Mormonism has a very unusual kind of ontology within the range of Christian thinking, because it refuses to treat matter and spirit as each other's opposites. And for that reason, it doesn't readily think in terms of dualistic oppositions. And a lot of the kinds of discussions around the dualisms of Christian thinking don't work out in at all the ways that you would expect in the case of thinking about Mormonism. So that was part of what motivated my interest in it. And as a sort of connection to the theme of conversion, which is our topic today, I should probably mention that the ward where I did most of my fieldwork in upstate New York consisted of about 50-50 descendants of pioneer families whose ancestors had gone out and done the handcart trek, if you've ever heard of this, where Latter-day Saints pushed all their worldly goods in little, like large wheelbarrows, if you've ever seen pictures of these, all the way from the eastern seaboard to Salt Lake City, most of them without any draft animals, in order to build that Zion in the desert. So half my informants were descendants of those original converts of the 19th century who'd gone out from England, Scandinavia and elsewhere. And about the other half were first-generation converts to the church. But they were American converts. They were almost all white American converts as well. And so this was not a situation of colonial conversion. And the dynamics of that situation are part of what have interested me in my work on Mormonism. And this, just very briefly, is the site of my current project, which is Bury St. Edmunds in Suffolk, as I expect many of you recognise, where Paola Filippucci from Newhall Murray Edwards College and I are currently engaged in a project called What Counts as Prayer, where we're looking at different meanings and negotiations of prayer-enabling space for clergy and for users of the cathedral space, including people from families and military bases in the surrounding Suffolk and Norfolk areas, and people involved in works of memory, particularly in family history and local history groups. So that's some of what I've worked on. But to sort of bring it to the question of anthropology and conversion more closely, I need to take you back to that book on the anthropology of Christianity that I briefly showed you as we looked through those pictures. And the question that I started with in setting out to do that project with a number of very fine co-authors whose studies are in there is the question of what difference Christianity makes to different kinds of local situations of practice. And underneath that question, I wanted to ask what kind of idea of Christianity my subject, anthropology, has and how we use it, and how social science in general has thought about Christianity and what it is, and how that would possibly limit the ways in which we imagine Christian practice, including situations of conversion. So in considering those questions, I came to the conclusion that, on the whole, anthropologists had tended to select and deploy a rather narrow understanding or model of what Christianity is. And in particular, that we had usually, though with a number of honourable exceptions, deployed a very Protestantised idea of what Christianity was, and had sort of made that Protestantised, over-selective, dehistoricised notion of the object of Christianity into far too sort of universalising a model of Christian practice. And in doing so, had eliminated a lot of the nuance of particular encounters in their historical situatedness, both with respect to the multiplicity of different Christian and missionary traditions and with respect to the reactions of local people in different case studies, as Thomas has just given us an example from his own research in Cameroon. So part of the argument I've made there, and this is again connected to the work of a large range of other people, but what I partly wanted to say was that anthropologists tended to focus on the idea that Christianity would be a highly transcendentalizing form of religion, which would create a situation in which people were forced to concentrate on and accept an economy of salvation model to choose between the here and now and the much more highly valued transcendental hereafter. And what went with that narrow model of Christian process and the process of conversion was a tendency to stereotype Christianity in terms of dualistic oppositions of the kind that I was mentioning in passing in relation to Mormonism's failure to reproduce them. So there were a number of points that I tried to bring out of that book, but one suggestion that we wanted to make was that a lot of the literature on the anthropology of conversion has, and again this connects with what Thomas was just saying about the Comoros, I think, has tended to shorthand the focus on Christian content and Christian interaction in favour of a focus on models of modernisation. And to my mind, this would in some ways include the work of the Comoros, rich though that is in many respects. And anthropologists have often, I think, tended to talk about conversion processes as though the real underlying story was the modernization process. And in fact, almost to think about modernity as itself, in an unrecognised way, modelled on certain kinds of tropes of conversion. That's to say, the kind of narrative of modernisation, which in many ways had come to dominate a lot of social science discussion, seemed to propose that one became irreversibly changed in a rather unilinear fashion by engagement with a universalised sort of force of modernisation. And that seemed to be an unrecognised use by anthropologists of a model of Christian conversion as irreversible, unidirectional change. But anthropologists were not very inclined to recognise this borrowing themselves, because, as you know, anthropologists and sociologists have generally considered themselves as having founded the first secular interpretations of social behaviour. So that had been kind of bracketed out of our account of our own tools. So a lot of the chapters in that book were attempts to look at and reinstate the particularities of those kinds of encounters. So we have, for example, Peter Gow, who's an Amazonianist, who talked about the Piro people. Piro people killed most of the sets of missionaries who first contacted them, but were eventually converted by the Summer Institute of Linguistics. And having been converted, the Piro claimed that they had always been Christian, and that no conversion process had taken place at all, that no change had taken place at all. Well, there's a chapter by another colleague of mine, Dan Lynn Rutherford, who was discussing Irian Jaya, just at the juncture between Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. And in Irian Jaya, people became very strong Protestants, Dutch Protestants, but they claimed that they had always expected change to come from over the seas. And therefore, when the Dutch missionaries arrived with a message of conversion and a message of radical change, this fulfilled entirely the Biak people's expectation that change would come and fulfil Biak prophecy. And therefore, the notion of radical change was again reintegrated, if you like, in different local models of what the significance of change might actually be in local life. Then very contrastively, my late colleague Olivia Harris, talking about people in the Andes, in the Bolivian and Ecuadorian Andes, who were converted by the Franciscan missionaries from the 16th century onwards. She found that the people who she worked with tended, on the other hand, to think of themselves as always requiring to reconvert themselves again and again and again, over and over, in an annual ritual in particular, without ever feeling that they were able to satisfy themselves that they had been converted. So the range of examples that we looked at tried to look at a number of different dimensions. We looked at different attitudes to words and objects as well, and to textuality. But one of the things that we were looking at is how people in different localities themselves would rate and cast what change means, and how it relates to local sort of ontological speculations, as well as to the specifics of the historical tradition of Christianity that they encountered. So I suppose that focus, that question about possibilities of continuity and change, has also dominated a wider area of anthropological discussion about conversion, some of which you may have been debating yesterday, but unfortunately I wasn't able to be with you. But if I may, I thought I would just mention three particular theorists who may or may not be people that you use yourselves in your own work. And these are Joel Robbins, who's just coming to the anthropology department here in Cambridge as a professor, and also Webb Keane, an anthropologist of Indonesia who works in the University of Michigan, and Talal Asad. I don't know whether these are people who you ever like to talk to or not, but you wish to tell me later perhaps. I'll try and tell you what I think they've been saying very, very briefly. So Joel Robbins, who's coming here to Cambridge, he was made a very significant contribution to this discussion by a book called Becoming Sinners, which is a discussion of conversion in Melanesia among people called the Oratman.
And Joel's contributions are too numerous for me to summarise properly. A lot of his discussion is to do with prompting anthropologists to think properly about conscious ethical areas of engagement, which is a very important thing to remind anthropologists of because of their tendency to overdo ideas about collective and ritual unconscious Durkheimian responses to social forces. But one of the things that Joel wanted to argue in Becoming Sinners is that the Arapnen people whom he was working with used Christianity in order to think consciously about processes of change that were happening to them. So they engaged with the form of Christian conversion, which was a form of evangelical Protestantism that they were brought by the missionaries who they met, on the basis of a preceding encounter with colonial law, which had convinced them that in order to negotiate with these outside forces, they needed to think about themselves as subjects in need of alteration. So, first of all, the encounter with colonial law gave the Arapnen the sense that they needed to change something about themselves in order to reach an accommodation with these outside powerful forces. Secondly, the encounter with the missionaries gave them an ethical language in which to reflect on that conundrum. And Joel's book is an exploration of that process of conscious reflection and action by the Arapnen. And he calls his book Becoming Sinners because part of his argument is that these particular forms of Christian mission tend to produce certain kinds of irresolvable tensions in the lives of people outside Western countries who adopt them in these colonial and post-colonial settings, because in particular, the universalism of the message requires each person to do ethical work for themselves, rather than being able to delegate it to particular groups of religious specialists. Whereas I think the Africanist John Peel, who Thomas also mentioned, and a number of other anthropologists of Africa, have sometimes found situations where convert populations are more comfortable with the idea of delegating the work of being Christian to particular subgroups of specialists within their communities. So Joel argued, thirdly, that anthropologists have been far too romantically obsessed with what he calls continuity thinking. He says anthropologists are too attached to the idea that people in local settings retain some of their own traditional ontological assumptions despite radical economic and political change going on outside their own control. And that this has led anthropologists to neglect the study of situations of radical change. So Joel's work partly is an attempt to redress that imbalance. And his work, his own commentary on the Comoros is partly critical in that respect. So that's Joel's work. The second kind of intervention was made by Webb Keane, who's an anthropologist of Indonesia. And Webb talked about a group of people in the island of Sumba in Indonesia, people called Anakalangis people, and they were converted to Christianity at the beginning of the 20th century by a particularly austere group of Dutch Reform Calvinist Protestant missionaries, who were also a particularly highly educated group of missionaries, all of whom, curiously, had read early anthropology, including the works of Marcel Mauss. So there was a strange kind of band of Dutch missionaries who'd read sociology going out to this island in the Indonesian archipelago. Now, Webb's work is concerned with what he calls the semiotic economy. And again, I don't know how much of this is familiar and used or not used by any of you. It may not be familiar at all, but just to give you a sense of the sort of terrains of discussion of what change might be in anthropology. So Webb wants to argue that what happens in situations of conversion is that you have two different economies of signs meeting each other. And these economies of signs will rarely be compatible. And in Webb's view, what gets exported with Western modernity, including missionization as a kind of subset of it, is a particularly dualistic form of thinking, which is dominated by the history of Protestantism in the West and its legacy in secularist thought. So this would be clearly the case for Dutch Calvinist missionaries going out to, you know, they obviously have a strong Protestant historical inheritance in their thinking. So to give you an example, Webb's kind of best example perhaps comes from a little article called Calvin and the Tropics that he wrote, where he pointed out that in this encounter between the Sumbanese missionaries, the missionaries to Sumba and the local people, each party accused the other of being idolaters. So the Dutch Reformed missionaries met the Sumbanese villagers and told them in the classic sort of trope that they must throw away their idols and cease to worship false images of God. The Sumbanese converts, on the other hand, were equally shocked by the conduct of the Dutch Reformed missionaries. And what shocked them in the message of these missionaries was firstly that the Dutch missionaries expected God to be always listening to you when you addressed him in prayer, an idea which struck Sumbanese villagers as extremely hubristic. Because when they talk to their own ancestors in traditional ritual, Sumbanese people apparently are very tentative in the expectation that anybody might be listening at all. Think that it's always a matter that's only going to be proved by the outcome. So they felt that these missionaries, in saying God is always, you know, hearing your prayer even if he's not going to give you exactly what you want, were kind of highly presumptuous in the way that they overvalued the compulsive force of the word. And that connected to another aspect of lack of fit between these two systems of signs in this account, which is that whereas Dutch Reform Christianity, in Webb Keane's account, is particularly sensitive to the problem of using language, a problem which says in using language we might always edge back into an idolatrous position. We might always find ourselves fixating on the language instead of on the reality of divinity, getting caught up in the idolatry of our own speech making. On the other hand, Sumbanese people think just the opposite. They think that there can be no possible communication in which the word does not have what they call a seat, which is a material aspect of the word, the world, and the two things must always go together in order for any form of communication to take place. So this is it might give you a little kind of sense of Webb Keane's work, but in his book, which is most widely read at the moment by anthropologists, which is called Christian Moderns, he really develops that argument, thinks about the processes of Sumbanese conversion, but focuses very much on the way in which the trajectory of Sumbanese movement was towards an insertion in the modern Indonesian state and the global order of signs, which the missionaries had helped to bring to them in that particular way. So the last person I wanted to mention rather briefly was Tal al-Assad, who's written books on the genealogy of Christianity and on the history of secularism as well. And Tal al-Assad is very suspicious, I think, of claims by Christian historians or anthropologists of Christianity that Christianity has any kind of real historical continuity in it at all, right? So for Tal al-Assad, I think, if I don't traduce his meaning too much, you know, conversion cannot really be discussed as a topic because, drawing on Foucault, Assad believes that any particular instance of it will always be altered from what it might have been before or what it might be next time, because every aspect of the basis of power and the relations between things and people will have been altered at different historical periods. But Assad, I think, in comparing traditions of Christianity and Islam, is rather hard on Christianity by comparison with Islam. And he's hard on it partly for political reasons, because he wants to criticize Christian and Western investments in languages of human rights, which he, Assad, regards as in many ways exclusionary and inhumane, as limiting the idea of what the human is too far, and of excluding certain kinds of experience, the kinds that Assad calls passionate agency. So his work is partly a criticism of Islamophobia in different kinds of Western traditions, political and intellectual. But on the other hand, in making that move, he tends to present Christianity as if it were simply a rather sort of poor kind of version of Islam. In particular, he thinks of Islam as a living tradition, capable of change, I suppose, through time, partly because of its acknowledged orality, its performativity. Whereas Christianity, he says very early, gains the delusion that it can write itself down as a text, and that its rituals in particular are in some ways able to be equated with texts. And once it's done that, for Assad, I suppose, Christianity becomes a false object because it thinks of itself, I suppose, he means, as a kind of stone that can drop unchanged through time, which for him would always be necessarily false, because he thinks nothing can pass unchanged through time at all. So those are three sets of debates that are going on in the anthropology of Christianity at the moment. And perhaps I hope I managed to give you a little bit of a sense of the fact that, in a way, all those arguments, to my mind, tend to do what Joel Robbins rather explicitly asks people to do, which is to move away from a romanticized fixation on the idea of continuity in anthropological discourse, and not to sort of, you know, overdo that kind of set of claims. Personally, I believe, because I was first trained as a historian, that there is obviously no such thing as any static moment in time, that historical context must always give specificity to any kind of described social encounter or practice. At the same time, I'm rather uncomfortable with these kinds of radical claims of discontinuity, and in particular with some of the tendencies which I think have come out of, in particular, some readings of Webb Keane's work, some readings of Talal Assad's work, which suggest that Christianity does not really have a sort of any kind of proper historical continuity worth concentrating on. And I think that in trying to sort of set those arguments up, these authors have themselves created certain kinds of lacunae. One gap that they have arguably created is to again go back to that fixation on the idea of modernization rather than looking at the content and process of Christian experience and Christian encounter. So I think myself, Webb Keane, focuses very much on people becoming modern in his book Christian Moderns, and rather less on them becoming Christians. So we don't, in fact, learn very much about what some of these Dutch Reform Calvinist missionaries think about God at any point in his book. Nor do we learn all that much about what Anakalangi's people think about the Christian God at any point in his book. And I find that rather an odd omission for a study of that kind, much as I enjoy his work. And similarly, I think some people, using the word of Komarovs, have tended to focus on processes of colonial modernization at the expense of attention to the particularities of experience and varieties of Christian experience in conversion encounter. So my own position would be to go back and think again about what it means to think both historically and in a way which gives proper recognition to Christianity's own processes for creating and underwriting its own continuity through its own processes of discussion and reflexivity, through its own traditions over time, which are extremely varied and sophisticated ones, as well as also thinking about the great variety of forms of reception of Christian ideas, and, as Thomas said also, the unpredictability of any encounter between particular forms of Christian agent at particular historical moments and particular local cultures whose ideas of change, as suggested at the beginning, may put the whole notion of conversion in an entirely different and far less overwhelming frame than those of the missionaries did.